Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, July 14, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss property rights and regulating the sharing economy. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to today's call. We will hear opening remarks from each of about 8 to 10 to 12 minutes, and then we'll have discussion and then some questions from the audience. We'll hear first from Christina Sandifer. She's the Executive Vice President of the Goldwater Institute. She'll be followed by Grady Gamage, Jr. He's the founding member of Gamage and Burnham. With that, Ms. Sandifer, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean, and thank you to the Federalist Society for having us today. I'm looking forward to sharing with you some of the solutions that we've invented in Arizona for dealing with regulations in property rights, especially in the sharing economy. I'd like to begin by telling you a story about a client of mine. His name is Glenn Odegaard, and until recently he was wanted for a crime that carries really stiff penalties, steep fines, and even jail time. So several years ago, Glenn traveled from the Phoenix area, where he's from, up into the mountains, a small historic mining town called Jerome, Arizona. It's known as America's most vertical city because it's built up a mile high up on the side of the mountains. And although it was a mining town and thriving at one time, when the mine shut down about half a century ago, the town had to sustain itself, and it has done so mostly through tourism. Glenn fell in love with the town, and he found a house that he really wanted to buy. The house was not your typical home sweet home. It was actually abandoned and had been left vacant for around 60 years after the home had been destroyed by a landslide that filled it with rocks and mud, and there was actually even a tree growing out of the middle of the home. But the reason that Glenn wanted to purchase this home is he saw an opportunity. He thought, you know, if I restore this house to its original condition, then I can recover my costs by renting it out as a vacation home so that when I'm not in Jerome, other people can enjoy the town as a tourist attraction. So Glenn purchased the home, and he transformed it from what was literally a health hazard to this historic, beautiful home that was featured on the cover of Arizona Highways magazine and that the Chamber of Commerce featured on one of its historic home walks. He really helped turn that area of Jerome around, but unfortunately, Glenn's reward for restoring the home was that the town considered him to be an outlaw. The town changed the rules after Glenn purchased the home, and they said that they were no longer going to allow vacation rentals in Jerome, and they decided to punish people with fines and jail time just for allowing overnight guests. Now, Glenn's story is really part of a disturbing national trend. The assault on property rights, I'm sorry to say, is nothing new, but we're really seeing a growing assault on property rights in the sharing economy. The sharing economy has really opened up new opportunities in home sharing, especially. It connects property owners and travelers in a way that we've really never seen possible before. Property owners are able to rent their homes to make some extra money. Many of them say that they rent their home so that it can help them pay their mortgages and keep the family home in the family instead of having to sell it off. But consumers really benefit from this, too, because people are offered more choices when they travel. Families get cheaper, more affordable options. They're able to rent homes so that they can cook instead of eating at the hotel every night. Often they're able to do so at lower prices. And communities are able to attract visitors who can then support the local economy. And people like Glenn are incentivized to buy homes that otherwise nobody would want to buy and live in and fix them up and maintain them so that they can rent them out and make money. And it's really interesting to think about the fact that in just a few short years, Airbnb, one of these sharing economy platforms, alone offers more rooms than a lot of the major hotel chains like Hilton and Marriott. So it really is quite a revolution that we're seeing. But unfortunately, regulators aren't welcoming these innovations with open arms as we might expect or hope. Instead, what they're doing is punishing people. Again, sometimes in Glenn's case, by criminal penalties, and they're really serious penalties. Part of the reason I think, is that these laws are often extremely difficult and expensive to enforce because really there isn't much difference between living full-time in your home or, you know, allowing a friend to spend the night on the couch or allowing guests to stay in your home for money. So cities are resorting to drastic measures that really don't do much to target any actual nuisance issues, which frankly aren't limited to home sharing anyway. Some examples, the state of New York lawmakers have recently decided to fine people up to $1,000 for allowing guests to spend the night in their apartments. And they're turning to crack down on online advertising. So what they're looking to do is actually outlaw using Airbnb and sharing economy platforms online, which actually has some very interesting First Amendment applications since those platforms are used purely to share information. But those regulations actually seem quite small when you compare them to Honolulu, Hawaii, where officials are actually combing the local beaches, interrogating visitors about where they're staying. And if they find out that a visitor is staying in a short-term rental, then they're fining homeowners of up to $10,000 per day for offering their homes as short-term rentals. And another example that Grady actually just sent me an updated article this morning about is that Santa Monica, California outlawed short-term rentals last year. And now over a year later, and after spending nearly $500,000 and creating a full-time task force in order to enforce that ordinance, again, they're difficult to enforce, the city is saying that they've now just convicted their first homeowner. Officials fined him $3,500 and put him on probation for 2 years for renting out his home. And so he said after 13 years of living in Santa Monica, he's just leaving California for good for another state that respects property rights. As you can see, these bans are really serious. They have serious consequences for homeowners, and they have serious consequences for travelers, and they punish innovation. But often they're justified as ways to prevent noise and limit neighborhood traffic, ways to really target nuisances in neighborhoods. Now, the statistics don't really show that short-term rentals contribute significantly to those types of neighborhood nuisances, but even if they did, it's understandable that people don't want to live near noisy neighbors and people want to control the traffic. But rather than enforcing existing city ordinances that forbid those types of nuisances, the problem is that governments are destroying property rights. I like to think of it this way. Cities don't ban backyard barbecues just because some of them might get rowdy now and then. Instead, what they do is they set noise and traffic ordinances and they enforce those. And they shouldn't think of home sharing any differently just because it's new or innovative. That's the way that cities should be doing this. But instead, sometimes these bans are even justified as pure protectionism. So local hotels chains are complaining that competition from Airbnb and other home sharing platforms are making it difficult for them to sustain their business. But of course, by that logic, then we shouldn't allow people to sleep on their friend's couch overnight because they're taking away business from the local Motel 6. Again, you know, this treatment of home sharing, for me, is really misguided. And I think it, if we take a step back, we can see how it clashes with our country's first principles. Our founding fathers knew that property rights are fundamental human rights. Truly, the right to ownership is the guardian of all other rights. You cannot exercise the rights that are protected in the Constitution if you don't have a right to ownership. You can't have freedom of the press if you can't own a printer, and you can't exercise your freedom of religion if you're not allowed to own a church, if the government could just come in and take those rights away from you at any time. And that's really why our founders included references to the right to own property more than any other right. But the problem is we're seeing years of bad court decisions and these increasing government regulations that are really chipping away at that respect for property rights. A lot of us are familiar with eminent domain abuse, which culminated in the Supreme Court's infamous Kelo versus New London decision about 11 years ago. In that case, the Supreme Court rubber-stamped government's decision to level private homes in order to clear property for private redevelopment projects. And lots of states, in light of that, passed protections for private property rights against eminent domain abuse, against the physical taking of a home. But at least when the government takes your property by eminent domain, it's required to pay you for it. The problem is that owners usually don't get paid for regulatory takings. They don't get paid when government takes away your right to use your property or to build on your property or in the case of home sharing, to rent your property. And there are some exceptions to this, but typically that's because government doesn't technically take title to the land, and there is still arguably some economic value to the land. So judges say that there's been no taking and owners aren't entitled to payment. And then what happens is that people aren't able to use their property as they see fit, but they're still stuck with the taxes, they're still stuck with the mortgage payments, and they're still stuck with possible liability if somebody comes over to your home and slips and falls, but they can't get any compensation for government coming and taking away those property rights. So at the Goldwater Institute, we identified this problem. We said, you know, states need meaningful protections for property rights that really change the way officials think about regulations and that really require them to think in the way that our founders intended. And these types of protections can encourage cities to focus on the excessive costs of regulations and also to focus on enforcing the legitimate rules that they already have on the books against nuisance rather than turning to destroying property rights. So with the couple of minutes I have left, I'd like to give you two examples of how Arizona has passed protections like that that really target regulation in the way that that our Constitution allows. First is 10 years ago, Arizona voters passed a Goldwater Institute reform that we call the Private Property Rights Protection Act. And at its core, it's really simple. It just requires government to pay you when it takes away your property rights, regardless of whether it does so by physically seizing your home and taking title through eminent domain or just regulating your rights away. So under that act, again, we treat true legitimate government purposes like protecting against health and safety differently from mere aesthetic regulations or community desires. So under the act, owners can be barred from polluting or using their land to cause nuisances, but they can't be prohibited from building or renovating or renting unless the government pays them for taking away those property rights. And for the lawyers on the call, unlike in federal court, under Arizona's act, government itself has the obligation of demonstrating that its regulations are actually protecting public health and safety in some meaningful way. So the government has to go to court, and if it can't prove that, then it has to pay property owners for taking away those rights. Now, officials often complain here in Arizona that paying makes regulation too expensive, but regulations like the regulations against home sharing often come as a cost. They always come as a cost to someone. And these types of regulations come as a cost to homeowners. So if the regulation isn't worth the cost to the community or the government in order to restrict those rights, then we say it certainly shouldn't be shouldered by the property owner alone. And what this law really does is it requires lawmakers to weigh the costs and benefits of the regulation. And that, we think, helps discourage excessive regulation. If the cost of regulating is too expensive, then probably it shouldn't be done. I'll finish with this. This year, Arizona passed another law that's aimed at discouraging excessive property rights regulation, but it's aimed specifically at this problem that we're discussing today, the problem of overregulating in the sharing economy, and with home sharing particularly. That law stopped local governments from passing these blanket bans on home sharing, these bans that say if you rent your home for under 30 days, it's illegal and you're a criminal, but if you rent your home for over 30 days, it's perfectly fine activity. That is illegal now in Arizona. Communities can still enforce nuisance rules that are on the books. They can still protect quiet, clean, and safe neighborhoods. But what they can't do is impose these one-size-fits-all bans that really cause more problems than they solve. At the bottom line, we say there are sensible ways to protect against health and safety concerns without undermining property rights, and we really want to force government to think about those problems and solutions on those terms. And so by doing that, in requiring cities and courts to respect property rights and to think about the way they regulate, other states can follow Arizona's example and really safeguard the fundamental right to ownership instead of turning responsible property owners into outlaws. With that, I look forward to your questions, and I'll turn it over to Grady.
Okay. Thank you, Christina. So I want to back up a little bit. Christina, I think, has created the impression that this is a new set of regulations created in response to Airbnb. And in fact, this line between what is residential use and what is essentially commercial use is something that goes way back early into
the era in which we began zoning ordinances. So zoning ordinances got their start in the United States in the 1920s, early 1900s, as the United States was industrializing. We came to realize the deficiency of nuisance law and nuisance protection is that it is only an after-the-fact remedy. You have to wait until something becomes a nuisance, and then you have to either sue, pursuing the private nuisance remedy, or if cities have regulations against a nuisance, you have to call the city and say, my neighbor's having a loud party every single night, and they have to come out every night to try to do something about that. Nuisance has its place, and it's a useful and an important remedy under tort law, but it's an after-the-fact remedy. And so zoning was largely created to try to guide the way in which land would be used and to recognize that certain uses have negative externalities that impact other people's property rights. That's the origin of zoning in the first place. Well, one of the fundamental principles of sort of Euclidean zoning was this notion that we would have residential zones that were designed for residential use only and not have commercial businesses. When you do that, you necessarily have to draw a line between what is residential use and what is commercial use. And that implicates things like I had somebody in my neighborhood who had a commercial business that involved selling out of a trailer that would go to a bicycle BMX meets. But what he was doing in my neighborhood was putting the trailer in his driveway and operating a shop, a commercial operation, every single weekend of the year. Now, we could sue him for creating a nuisance. We could sue him in that case for violating the covenants in my neighborhood, which also regulate this kind of thing. But those are both expensive, time-consuming remedies that involve going to court. We had a regulation in the city of Phoenix, this is, that said you can't have a garage sale more than four times a year, and you're supposed to be selling used merchandise at a garage sale. So the city shut him down. It was a very effective remedy. It got rid of a commercial use in my neighborhood that was really negatively impacting the neighbors. Another example of where this line needs to get drawn is with regard to home occupations. Typically in a residential neighborhood in most cities in America, you can have an office and conduct a home occupation. But there's usually two limits to that. One is that you can't have people coming to your home in order to receive services because that creates parking issues and other issues. And the second is that you can't have employees who don't live in the home. Another attempt to draw this line between commercial and residential. Most cities that have sophisticated and comprehensive zoning ordinances have long had a line that tries to distinguish between the overnight lodging of guests and the permanent residential use. And these have been drawn in various ways. I think the most common one is that you can rent your home out, but you can't rent it for a period of less than 30 days. A proxy for a stable residential use. Whereas if you're renting it every night by the night, it's more like a hotel, and it has with it some externalities. It may have with it people who have more cars, drive more, party more. It has people staying in the home who don't have this kind of shared investment in the neighborhood. And I have this experience as well. I have a cabin in the mountains, and I have a vacation rental right across the street from it. It is essentially a party house. It is rented by people to have parties every weekend, and it's very noisy. Christina's right. I have a nuisance remedy. I can sue the owner of that house. I really don't want to do that. He's sort of a friend of mine. I tried to talk him out of it. I can call the county, but the county sheriff is about 30 miles away, and he won't come out very often. It would be a lot easier if there was a clear, bright line that we could draw about what's permitted and what's not. And because this is a rural Arizona county, it doesn't have such a line. I'm somewhat familiar with the situation in Jerome that Christina talked about, and I think what happened to Mr. Odegaard is not fair, frankly, because in Jerome, they didn't have one of these pre-existing ordinances that said you can't rent your house out by the night. We have had an ordinance like that in the city of Phoenix since about 1980. Sedona, which is another vacation destination in Arizona, has had an ordinance like that since 1985. So people in both of those communities and many communities have been fully on notice as to what the regulations were, and most people have bought afterwards and they haven't been violating that. Those long-standing pre-existing regulations were invalidated by the regulations that Christina touts as a great victory of the Goldwater Institute passed by the legislature this year. So suddenly, you know, many neighborhoods in places like Phoenix and Sedona are opened up to unanticipated and previously illegal hotel-type uses. Now, most of the time, those are not, frankly, going to be a big problem, but there are a whole series of different ways in which communities might have dealt with this problem and might have regulated it. There are communities that regulate how many maximum nights during the year you can rent your house out for one night at a time stays. There are communities that had four-day minimum stays, hoping to get a less transient nature. There are communities, I'm not sure how you do this, but that have requirements on vacation rentals that are not unlike the requirements many communities put on adult business uses, which is a dispersal requirement. You can only have so many of these in any one neighborhood. I'm troubled by how you draw the line between who gets one and who doesn't in that circumstance. I'm not sure how that works. There are communities that say, look, you can rent a bedroom anytime you want. If the house is owner-occupied, we don't mind additional people staying there. It's not having any owner on site, not having anyone who is responsible for the sort of quiet enjoyment of the neighborhood. And there are communities that limit how many vacation rentals may be owned by a single owner. And this is really designed to deal with the problem where somebody goes in and buys up 20 houses in a resort area and starts renting them by the night or 20 condos. There was a BBC, I think, podcast this morning that somebody was telling me about, I didn't hear it, about how in Barcelona an entire neighborhood is being displaced by vacation rentals taking over. So none of those regulations, as I read Arizona's new statute, are now permitted in Arizona. And I'm troubled by the absence of the ability of a local government to adapt its zoning regulations to a local problem. I think there may well be circumstances where there's significant overreach. As Christina said, I sent her the Santa Monica thing, which sounds a little crazy. But I'm not sure that there are no circumstances ever when vacation rentals should not be regulated. Because I think there are circumstances in which they can become a significant and unanticipated change to the nature of the neighborhood. Two final things I would say. One is that I mentioned earlier, many, many newer neighborhoods have covenants that prohibit this kind of thing. We do a lot of drafting of covenants for master plan communities in our office, and our standard covenant provision is actually a six-month prohibition. Unless you are leasing your house for a period of 6 months or more, you can't rent it out by the month or by the week, certainly not by the night. So people who are excited about using their home as a VRBO ought to check their covenants. Those are private matters, private contracts. Those are not invalidated by the Arizona statute as regulation is. And the last thing I would say is there is, I think, a significant difference between Uber and Airbnb in this regard. I'm all for Uber. I think Uber's great. The only negative externality, the only downside of what Uber is doing is it is shaking up an entrenched, necrotic industry, taxi cabs, that frankly needed to be shaken up. The taxi industry needed something to reform it. And the downside is it's hurting cab companies, and the value of a New York taxi medallion goes down by more than 50% as a result of Uber, as I understand it. But that's competition. That's free enterprise. That's what happens. I'm fine with that. This is a little different. I don't have a lot of sympathy for hotels who complain about Airbnb rentals. I view that as being somewhat like the taxi cab analogy. That's not the problem with freely opening up any residential neighborhood to buy-the-night rental. The problem is the negative externality because it's a land use. And that's what zoning was about, and that's where these regulations come from, is trying to protect against negative externalities. When the Arizona legislation passed, I thought it was fascinating that one of the people who voted against it and who said, gee, I really never signed up for having a hotel next to me, is one of the most conservative members of the state legislature. And this is something that's always fascinated me about land use law in general, is we have a clash between sort of deeply held conservative feelings on behalf of people. One is that property rights are incredibly important and should be protected. But the other is that if you're a conservative, you really care about the quiet enjoyment of your house, and you really don't want unexpected change to take people by surprise and to disrupt a lifestyle that they invested in. And so in that sense, I think opening up any neighborhood to free, open, unlimited Airbnb may very well impact on the property rights of other people who've invested in that neighborhood. So I'll turn it back to you at that point, Dean, and I guess we'll open up for questions or comments or more back and forth.
Indeed. Thank you very much. I want to give Christina Sandifer a chance to respond. Before we do that, let's let people begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for either or both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller question, but let me go back to Christina Sandifer and give her a chance to expand on her comments and respond to Grady Gamage.
Well, great. Well, I'll start with Grady's last comment, because I think we are in absolute agreement that that allowing Uber to operate is a good thing, and we disagree though on the disanalogy. I think Uber, what's happening in the Uber taxi market is exactly what's happening here in the home market. It is the Airbnb and VRBO are bringing competition to the home market, and they're also bringing competition to the way that neighborhoods are put together and the way that people want to live their lives. I think it's really important here when we talk about zoning to be very careful about how we use the term property rights. And I think some of Grady's comments conflated what is a property right and what is just a community desire. You absolutely do not have a right to use your property in a way that causes a nuisance and that harms somebody else. And so we already have regulations on the books that deal with any nuisances that happen to be caused by short-term rentals, and frankly, any nuisances that happen to be caused by long-term neighbors. It's certainly not a problem that's limited to short-term rentals, and the statistics actually show otherwise. But you do not have a property right in maintaining the character of a neighborhood or in protecting yourself against changes that may come as to the neighborhood as people move in and out. And this shared investment that Grady refers to is really, I think a misterm here, because when people enter into contracts, Grady mentioned HOAs and CC&Rs, deed restrictions, things like that, there they actually do have a shared investment. You've agreed to give up your right to use your property in a certain way in exchange for others in the neighborhood doing the same. And there we have an enforceable contract. So if we don't want pink houses or we don't want people renting out their homes, we can do that in that neighborhood. But I don't have a property right to tell my neighbors how they can use their property unless, of course, they're doing so to cause a nuisance.
Well, let me ask, can I ask Christina a question then? If I understand what you just said, Christina, you believe it would be okay for me to decide in my residential home in the middle of my neighborhood that 7-Eleven needs some competition and I can open up a bodega and sell things out of my house because nobody has a right to keep me from doing that. You're okay with that?
In fact, I'm perfectly okay with that. I do believe in that, but I don't even think we have to go so far for this conversation, because I think we can target the nuisance. You know, one of the things you said is that there ought to be an existing clear, bright line when it comes to how people can use their homes. And in fact, there is an existing clear, bright line, and that is these restrictions against nuisances. And I think that when we ban an activity when we draw an arbitrary line, 30 days versus 31 days for rentals and things like that, what we're really doing is enforcing the very things that you said. We're enforcing a preferred lifestyle that that some neighbors may have, and trying to protect people against change to a neighborhood, which really is not a proper function of government.
See, I can get to there. I disagree with that, but I understand your rationale, and I understand that having people living in the dwelling, even if it's only for one night at a time, is still kind of mostly pretty much a residential use. I would allow some regulation of that. I wouldn't preempt it at the state level, but I'm a little skeptical about how much regulation it really needs. So I'm kind of with you that far. But the notion that I should be able to open up a retail store in my house in the middle of a neighborhood, I think that's that would do away with zoning, essentially. And I don't think most Americans would be comfortable with that conclusion.
Well, and I don't think that that's really a fair comparison here, because it's not really what's happening. You know, it's interesting the hotels complain.
No, but you just said you were okay with that.
Well, I am okay with that, but that's not what we're really talking about here, because here the hotels complain. They say, you know, Airbnb comes in and they compete with us, but they don't have to always pay the same types of taxes we pay, so we ought to make those uniform across the board, because they're basically operating like hotels. But in fact, they're really not operating like hotels in a lot of ways, although I'd be perfectly fine, and the Arizona law allows for the collection of taxes.
Yeah, but Christina, I thought we had a pact not to talk about taxes, because neither of us understands it very well.
No, we're not going to. We won't get into the tax issue.
There is a tax issue in all of this, but
right.
Neither Christina or I want to understand that very well.
No, we are not. But the point there is that the hotels want, and some people want to treat renting out your home or allowing somebody to stay in your home as if it were the same thing as a hotel, and that's the analogy you're making when you say somebody opening up a 7-Eleven in their own house, and that's just not what we're talking about.
No, that's not the analogy I'm making. I'm not trying to defend 7-Eleven or trying to defend the hotel industry. I'm talking about the externalities of land uses.
And that's
I would not want a commercial business next to my house. There has to be some kind of governmental function that I'm a zoning lawyer, so I'm going to defend what I do for a living. There has to be some kind of governmental function that tries to give guidance as to what your neighborhood is going to be like, how your investment is going to be protected over the long term, and what kind of externalities you can expect to be created by the land uses around you. That's what zoning's about. And that, to me, is a very sort of fundamental bedrock principle of the way American municipalities operate since the early 20th century.
Well, and I'm a property rights lawyer, so I will defend what I do for a living and say that there absolutely is, in fact, a way to do that. That's through existing zoning ordinances and enforcing ordinances against nuisances that
actually
park.
Wait. Now you're okay with zoning ordinances, but you don't think prohibiting commercial uses in a residential zone is okay? Well, then what are zoning ordinances for? That's what they do.
In this context, exactly what I'm saying is that what we ought to do is enforce the zoning ordinances against noise, against traffic, against all of the things that are actually nuisances, and not blanket ban particular activities just because they might cause a problem in the future. Instead, what we need to do is enforce those zoning ordinances strictly. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at these. When you look at cities, you mentioned, I don't recall where you said it was, but you mentioned that you have a home where the neighbor often rents out to other people and that the police officers don't usually come. They're about 30 minutes away. It takes a long time to call them. It strikes me as odd that if we're not doing a good job putting time and resources into enforcing our nuisance ordinances, which are the problems that you think really need to be prevented, these nuisances, it's really not going to be more helpful to create another right level of regulation that is even more costly to taxpayers to enforce, that's even more difficult to enforce, and frankly is not targeting the problem.
But actually they're easier to enforce. The problem with nuisance is the cop's got to get out there and see if it's really happening, or he's got to issue an after-the-fact citation, and then somebody's going to deny it, and we're going to have to get into court about it and everything else. If you have rules in advance that prescribe what you're allowed to do with your property, then that's put everybody on fair notice as to what the rules are. There's not a lot of interpretation as to whether something is or is not a nuisance. Is two extra cars at the house across from me a nuisance, or is it, does it have to be six extra cars to rise to the level of a nuisance? It's very difficult to enforce nuisance laws. And that was the failure that is recognized in like Bove versus Donahan or Coke Company in the early 20th century cases that recognized the limitations of nuisance and basically gave rise to the existence of zoning. Dean, we should let you get a word in edgewise here at some point.
Yes, that's what I do for a living, is moderate calls like this. So let me see if we can get the audience engaged here. This is a very interesting back and forth, so I let it carry on for a while. We've got two callers now with questions. If you'd like to join the queue, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our first call of the day.
Thanks very much, Dean. This is Steve Tepp. I'm active in the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Executive Committee. And Christine, I share very much your passion for property rights. As an intellectual property attorney, when I hear the term sharing economy, I think back to what I think is the first iteration of the sharing economy, which was peer-to-peer file sharing, which was really not sharing at all. It was the theft of constitutionally recognized copyright rights for the financial benefit of the operators of those platforms. And so I'd appreciate if you could spend a minute or two commenting on how, at least in some cases, there are types of so-called sharing that in fact are not consistent with the protection of property rights. And in fact, I'd love to follow up with you offline to continue that conversation. Thank you.
Sure. Well, thank you for that question. I'd also love to follow up with you offline. I am not a specialist in intellectual property, and for reasons that probably would be best addressed in another call where we can spend another hour talking about them, I see some real differences between so-called intellectual property and physical property. And so I think in some ways it's hard to draw comparisons between the two. But here I think it's a lot, you know, it's a lot easier. Grady mentioned that it's very difficult, that he thinks it's very difficult to enforce against nuisances. But when we look at the basic principles here, and we start with first principles, and we look at the principles of protecting private property and freedom, and that those are our central values and they are our core principles, then we have to err on the side of protecting property rights. And it ought to be the job of the government in both of these cases that that we're discussing, whether it's physical property or intellectual property, to show that there is some sort of violation. The police should have to show up and see that there is actually a noise problem or a traffic problem in order to tell a property owner that he has to stop using his property as he sees fit. We don't want to make the presumption against the liberty to be able to use your property or to be able to share your property and instead pass blanket bans on the sharing of physical or intellectual property. So my sense is that if we believe in property rights as the virtue that they are, then the presumption ought to be in favor of liberty, and the government ought to have to come in and show that there is actually a nuisance or a violation.
I'd like to take what the caller raises in a little bit different direction, which is sort of a philosophical big picture issue that I think underlies all of this and is about the impact of the sharing economy over the long term. I think it's very possible that the sharing economy will lead us to thinking differently about the nature of property than we have in the past. A lot of what Christine and I have been debating has been a fairly fundamental difference built into our legal framework about a difference between sort of consumption or personal use property and commercial property. There's a fascinating article by an Israeli law professor named Shelley Kreitzer-Levy in the Pepperdine Law Review recently about the nature of the shared economy and a conceivable third sort of class of property, shared property, that is neither personal consumption property nor commercial property, and what that may mean over the long term and how we may have to reconceptualize the nature of property. An example here comes from the intellectual property world, which is A lot of us think we own the software on our computers. Well, we really don't. We have a license that we checked a little box and didn't read the small print about that says we don't own it, but says that we have the right to use it under a set of circumstances. As we go toward an era of, for example, autonomous vehicles, we may not own those cars anymore. We will just have some kind of right to use them. If a single-family dwelling is owned by someone who doesn't live there and is used in an overnight rental context, it has all sorts of implications for the kind of insurance that's needed, for the right to exclude people. Does the Fair Housing Act apply to those by-the-night rentals? Do you have to comply by the rules that apply generally to commercial property about that? Are the rules about the right to defend yourself if you are confronted in your dwelling, do those apply if you're renting a single-family home by the night, or do they only apply to the owner if he happens to be there? There are lots of issues, and I think this is really interesting over the long term. There are lots of issues baked into the way we've thought about property in the past that are probably going to need to evolve and change as we move into the more shared-use economy.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We still have two callers with questions. Let's take another call now.
Yes, my name's Stephen Casey. I'm in Austin, Texas. I grew up in Houston. And, you know, it seems to me that the debate being on what level to do this, if we really want to look at the idea of the right of people to contract and protecting natural rights, I think Houston's a pretty good example, because so much of that, the decision making on where to draw the boundaries, has been pushed to the people. There's a case in 2014 where the skyscraper, there's a large building that was being built next to his residences, and they said, yeah, you can go ahead and develop it, but there was a nuisance suit, and you're going to pay damages for the people that are around you. And the jury got to decide. 21-story development next to the neighborhood was too big in the eyes of the jury, and I think that takes it from a top-down approach, which seems really restrictive, puts it into a bottom-up approach. That was my comment, but I want also to suggest that the analogy over to intellectual property, I think, is a little misconstrued, because IP finds its backbone, its basis in constitutional protection, which is a positive act of law, rather than some sort of natural right, because without the positive statutory constitution protection, you wouldn't have copyright protection. It wouldn't be defensible. So I think the natural right source and origin of this is the way to go. And just like extra regulation, if the laws aren't working to begin with, one extra layer out, I think this doesn't happen. Doesn't aid it. So it's a little superfluous.
Really appreciate your comments there. Just a couple additional thoughts. Completely agree that, you know, private contracts really are the way to go in order for communities to be able to have more decision-making authority over the nature or character or quality of the community. And I think there's a real difference between people who are contracting, you know, say through an HOA or through a deed restriction, so that each person is buying into that decision making, and each person is giving something up in order to have a community that everyone's agreeing to have, versus a law imposed or by a city or a town that says, well, gosh, the majority of people, sometimes, as we know, it's not even the majority, that live in this town would really like a certain quality or characteristic of people, and there's undesirable people that we would really like to keep out, you know, the types of people that we don't really want in this neighborhood, and so we're going to prevent certain, you know, short-term rentals or things like that, so that we can keep those undesirables out of our community, or so that we can keep our community, you know, in a certain way. And that's the reason that we designed the Private Property Rights Protection Act and require communities to at least pay for taking away those property rights, because those aren't decisions being made by each individual homeowner. They're decisions being imposed by a democratic majority on individuals in a way that, you know, that truly violates or restricts their rights. And so I think Houston is definitely more similar to a model that respects property rights than what we have in many cities today.
So I want to quarrel with that some. I just this year I wrote a book called The Future of the Suburban City that is largely about Phoenix and whether or not Phoenix is sustainable. But one of the things that troubles me, that worries me about the future of a lot of the urban fabric that has been built in the post-war era in America is the covenants that effectively freeze neighborhoods in a way that they cannot change and evolve. My law firm draws up covenants for master plan communities. I live in a master plan community with a lot of covenants. Generally, I'm supportive of the notion of contracting to create a neighborhood character, but there's a downside to that. The downside is that covenants are designed to freeze a neighborhood in a way that it can never change, and that's just not the way cities adapt and grow and evolve. If you think about the history of New York City, there were once great mansions where there are now 50-story high-rises. It needed to evolve. If those areas had had the kind of covenants that are imposed in most of Houston, and indeed in most of Phoenix, though we also have zoning, that could never have happened. Zoning can be changed. Zoning is a political decision, and it is therefore malleable over time. Covenants either require a very high percentage of the people in the neighborhood, like 75%, to make any adaptation or change, or in many cases in Arizona, by court decision, it requires 100% of the people in the neighborhood to release a lot, for example, from a covenant. And I'll go back to Christina, this is sort of closer to your heart. There are lots in Phoenix that are now single-family homes fronting on major arterial roads that have 200,000 cars a day on them. Those should turn into commercial uses, but they can't because they have covenants, and it would take 100% of the people within the subdivision to agree to release that lot. Well, that's an impossible standard. So I generally support the concept of covenants, I worry that we have made it so difficult to modify or amend them over time that it doesn't allow the natural evolution that should happen in cities over long periods of time.
If I may, I find it sort of ironic that you would say that the problem with covenants is sometimes they stop cities from evolving or changing, when that's exactly what these types of regulations that prohibit home sharing do. The entire purpose of them, if we take away the nuisance portion, which again can be better addressed by actual nuisance regulations, the entire purpose is to freeze a neighborhood in a certain way.
Phoenix had a 30-day ordinance. If the 30-day ordinance is a legitimate problem and there's much more demand for that, then you can repeal it. You can change it.
But
if there's
decides?
A covenant that says that, you can't change it. It's the difference in the modification system between the two.
That is very true, but that's true on the flip side as well, right? Because it comes down to who decides. So you say sometimes property ought to be commercial or it ought to be residential or it ought to evolve in a certain way. Well, who should decide that? The people who own the property? And yes, you're right. If they make that decision, it does require a very high threshold because those property owners all have to vote on how they want their property treated. Or should you or should a government bureaucrat decide how the community should go, what direction it should go?
Neither one, Christina. It should be elected officials. That's what representative democracy is about. It's the city council. That's how it works. That's how we ought to allow cities to evolve and change, is we elect people to make representative decisions.
Let me break in here. We've got three questions pending now. We've got a little bit more than 10 minutes, so I want to hear from additional members of the audience.
I'd like to thank both panelists. I have a question for Grady, a two-part question on this issue as to what's a better vehicle to address, protect private property owners and protect the nature of the community, whether it's zoning rules or nuisance. You basically made two arguments that zoning was preferable. The first was that it was expedient, I think is the word that you used, for zoning laws to address potential, though not actual, negative externalities. But, of course, the cost of zoning ordinances are borne by the entire community. So the first question is, shouldn't the cost actually be borne by those who are most directly affected by an actual negative externality rather than the whole community? And related to that, you also said it was very difficult to enforce nuisance laws. Well, you know, it's also very difficult to comply with a labyrinth of zoning regulations, particularly for people who maybe can't afford to hire somebody like Grady Gamage to do it for them. Shouldn't the burden fall on the government to enforce the law rather than on property owners to comply with a whole maze of regulations?
Yeah, well, let me take the first one. There is a rich body of literature about bargaining to deal with land use externalities, and why can't we solve all of this by just bargaining about it? And the dilemma, let me go back to the example of the guy in my neighborhood who was setting up a trailer and operating a commercial business in his front yard every weekend. One of the things we could have done would have been to try to bargain him out of that. Well, we did that. We went to talk to him, and he said, you know, I'm making $1,500 every weekend. You guarantee me $1,500 a week? I'll quit doing this. Well, the reality is I live 3 blocks away. It wasn't worth anything to me to get him to stop doing it. I would have thrown in 20 bucks just out of the goodness of my heart to my neighbors. To the guy who lived next door to him, it was a major detriment to the quality of life in his home. But $1,500 a week is a lot for him to have to spend. So part of the concept of zoning is to kind of spread the costs of those negative externalities over a larger area. And that's what communities are about. It's sort of the spreading the cost to the community. I don't think you can solve the problem by just bargaining because the transaction costs are just too high and too difficult. I'm sorry, I forgot the second question. The second part.
So you'd indicated it was difficult to enforce for the government to enforce nuisance laws.
The enforcement issue and the red tape of going through zoning regulations. Either way, regulations are complicated and are difficult. I think, though, what I see as preferable about zoning regulations is that they operate in advance of the establishment of a use. Nuisance only operates prospectively after the use is established. So in many of the early 20th century cases, what was happening was, in the Donner Hanna Coke is the one that's taught in every law school in America, basically, a Coke factory, Coke not Coca-Cola, but turbocharged coal, went in near a home. And it probably was a nuisance, but once the Coke factory's built, you're not going to shut it down. We have a legendary case in Arizona called Spur Feeding that's taught in most law schools. It's about Sun City and a bunch of retirement people moving near a feedlot. It's a kind of coming to the nuisance case. That nuisance, once a use is established, shutting it down is enormously costly and disruptive to the person who probably established it legitimately, not realizing it was going to be a nuisance and that it was going to create problems for the neighbors. If you have zoning, you can say in advance, you know, a Coke factory near these homes is probably not a good idea. That's unfortunately a mucked up case by whether or not the homes should have been there in the first place. But the idea of zoning is to give guidance in advance as to what kinds of land uses can compatibly be established in an area. I think it is always better from a property rights perspective to tell people in advance what the rules are rather than to make them up after the fact. And that's one of the points Christina has made, I think quite appropriately, is that often imposing these short-term rental requirements in areas where they did not previously exist would violate the principle I just articulated, that you shouldn't change the rules on people once they've established a use. That is the principle of nonconforming use. That is embedded in every state enabling statute in America. It's different in different ones. It goes back to the Standard Zoning Enabling Act. We have very strong protection of nonconforming uses in Arizona. We do not put them out of business. Once they're established, they get to keep going. That is a recognition of the importance of protecting an investment someone has made based on the existing government rules, and that you can change them after the fact, but you can't put that guy out of business if he started legitimately in the first place. And that's what the aggressive use of nuisance would wind up doing. So it doesn't seem to me to solve the problem.
I want to come back to Christina, but Christina, we have two questions pending. Let me open the phones for those two people, get their questions on the floor, and then I'll give you a chance to respond to whatever you'd like.
Sounds great. I'll try to be brief there. So I guess my only comment there would just say that, you know, certainly there is value to setting clear rules in advance. That is a principle embedded in American rule of law, that people ought to know what is and isn't illegal before they take action. But it, again, with zoning, we have to be addressing actual nuisances, actual health and safety problems, actual legitimate functions of government, and by implication from what Grady is saying, you know, it's certainly a lot easier to make people ask the government for permission before they do anything, before they open their front door, before they do anything with their property. In fact, that would be the same with speech as well. It's a lot easier to avoid externalities if I ask the government for permission before I say something to make sure I'm not going to hurt somebody's feelings. That's not how we operate in this country. In this country, we value freedom as a fundamental first principle, and sometimes that gets a little bit messy, and sometimes
Nor is that how zoning works, Christina.
Before you respond, Grady, let me, if I could, go to these final two callers.
Okay.
And then, Christina, you can say whatever you have to say in response to the two callers. I'm going to ask the callers to be extremely brief since we're running out of time here.
Hello, this is Manny Klausner calling from Los Angeles. Very interesting discussion. I'm going to keep this brief. I want to mention a name, one of the leading figures in the whole argument about land use, zoning laws, and deed restrictions, and that's the great Bernie Siegan, who died 10 years ago and wrote a seminal book, Land Use Without Zoning, around 1972. He taught for many years at the University of San Diego Law School. One point I'd just like to toss out and get a response if there's time, and that is, there are trade-offs in either system. If you get zoning laws, that doesn't give any degree of security to property owners when special interests or big political donors come sniffing around and talk to the Spiro Agnews on the zoning boards to try to get some favorable change in the zoning law. So there's no security as against the deed restriction, which offers security. On the other hand, what about deed restrictions that aren't so confining, that don't require 100% to change, maybe two-thirds or whatever you want to say, and maybe you make a showing. And you can – good planners and good drafters of zoning law – of deed restrictions can easily have practical, realistic provisions that aren't as confining as 100% consent. That's my comment, and thanks again for the conversation.
Thank you for the comment. Yeah, but before you respond, Christina, let me try and get this last question out on the floor, and then you can respond to whichever you'd like. Let's take this final call now.
Hi, my name is Marion Cook, and I'm a board member of the Goldwater, so I'm biased towards Christina and her great work. My observation is more historical than a legal question. I'm old enough to well remember when boarding houses were, at least in my grandmother's time, de rigueur, and they didn't have the zoning. Then there were the tourist homes in a paucity of big hotels. It was very common in residential areas for often just a woman to open her home to tourists passing through, which is a very different scenario, of course, from partying. But I think our historical perspective has changed. I remember when black neighborhoods were one black family in the entire neighborhood was ruined in terms of commercial value, and you had white flight. So I think sociology plays a huge role in our acceptance or our resistance to this above and beyond the law. Without dismissing the legal concept, I think it'd be a fatal mistake to deny the organic evolution of what is and is not acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you. Christina Sandiford, let me give you 60 seconds, and we'll follow that with 60 seconds from Grady Gamage, and then we're going to have to adjourn, I'm afraid. Christina.
All right, great. Well, I thank you, Marion, for your comment, and to Manny's, I'll just say that that's exactly right. The volatility of the democratic process is the very reason for which we have a constitution, because there are special interests and tyranny of the majority that can really destroy property rights and put people's rights subject to the whims of the democracy. And that's why we take property rights and we take certain things out of the hands of the democratic majorities, and we protect them, and we require government to justify its regulations when it's going to go ahead and regulate property rights.
Final thought from Grady Gamage.
Yeah, I agree with Marianne. A lot of this is about sort of changing mores and changing expectations in society. And I am not sure where people are exactly in thinking about Airbnb-type uses. I have used them. I've done it. I think most of the time it works pretty well. To Manny's comment, he's right. I mean, there is no perfect way to do this. For my part, I am relatively comfortable with representative democracy. I think Christina's right. There have to be limits to it, and those limits should protect private property rights. I totally believe in the Fifth Amendment takings clause. But I think there are times when, from the libertarian perspective or the Gold Order Institute perspective, we're getting a little carried away with limiting the power of government to sort of regulate that which is necessary to make society function in an orderly way for the benefit of most of its citizens without impinging too much on people's private property rights.
Well, I wish we had more time, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. Maybe we'll have you both back at some point in the future. We certainly appreciate this. This is a lively and very interesting discussion. To our audience, thank you as well for dialing in. Do check the Federalist Society's website. Monitor your emails for the next teleforum conference call. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.